In 1959, Farah Diba, a young architecture student and the daughter of an Iranian army officer, had afternoon tea at the palace of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. She was soon invited to another tea, then dinner and drives through the city. Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was smitten. He proposed. And in December of that year, 21-year-old Farah Diba became the Empress Farah, the third wife of the Shah of Iran. 19 years later, months of strikes, riots, and religious protests overwhelmed the monarchy, and the couple fled into a kind of floating exile, touching down in Egypt, the United States, Mexico, and Panama. The Shah was also sick and needed medical care. The Ayatollah Khomeini returned from exile in France to Iran and proclaimed a new Islamic Republic. The Shah died of cancer a year later in Egypt. Empress Farah is one of some 4 million Iranian exiles who were scattered by the forces of history around the world. 1 million Iranian exiles live in the United States. The Empress has just published a memoir about her life with the Shah. We visited her at her home outside of Washington, D.C. Many walls hold modern art sent to her by Persian artists who were banned in today's Iran. And everywhere there are scores of family pictures of her husband, their children, including daughter Leela, who took her life 3 years ago at the age of 31, and grandchildren. A bronze bust of the Shah rests on a pedestal in the living room.
Sometimes I go and touch him, touch his forehead. And sometimes I ask him to help me, to guide me. And there are all these pictures which are lovely.
You're really surrounded by images of Iran, aren't you?
Yes. It helps me to not feel too much in exile.
Empress Farah, at the age of 65, is still a tall and elegant woman. She recalls the day when the Shah asked for her hand in marriage.
The first thing he told me was, as a queen, you will have responsibilities towards your country and your compatriot.
You made the interests of women a particular area of concern.
Yes, and I was not alone because there were so many ladies who had worked even before 1963 when they got the right to vote and to get elected. And I say now, after what has happened in the last 25 years in Iran, that really I never felt in those days that as a woman, mm-hmm. I'm not allowed to do some things. And with the help and studies of many Iranian ladies, all the changes in the laws for women, the family protection law, the problem of divorce, custody of the children, mm-hmm. age of marriage, access to education and different jobs, and the freedom to wear what they want, and the question of polygamy. Almost women reached a point that almost equal right with men in those days.
Empress, as you look back on it with the advantage of 25 years of hindsight, why was the king overthrown?
Every year, all these last 25 years, when we Iranians sit around, we say, what happened? Why did it happen? Mm-hmm. And we all have different reasons. And if I had only one thing to say, is that if there was maybe more political opening, participation in the early 70s, maybe this would not happen.
Had your husband's administration opened itself more?
I think so. Of course, this is with hindsight. It mm-hmm. could have happened earlier with all the problems, and we have to put ourselves in the context of that period, because frankly, with all the discontent, there were not problems that could not be solved. It didn't need such a horrible revolution, which I call a catastrophe with mythological dimension, really. And also the problems that automatically development and progress creates. Mm-hmm. My husband wanted, from a country which was in the Middle Ages, in the beginning of 20th century, to bring Iran to development, modernity. But of course, these social changes created problems among the society, because after especially the 1963 revolution, white revolution, what we call, and the women's emancipation, the education of women made many of the religious leaders unhappy because they didn't believe in it, and they showed what they believe in the mm-hmm. last 25 years.
These are some of the same religious leaders who ultimately took power in Iran. When you go back, as we have, and you might have to read some of the contemporary accounts in the late 1970s, one thing that keeps coming up almost more than any other from the perspective of the West is SAVAK, the secret police, your husband's secret police, and the charge that under his rule in Iran there were thousands of political prisoners. There were thousands of people who were tortured. Do you think that this had the effect of spurring the revolution?
I say the SAVAK, like every police in every country, is there for the security and stability of the country. Then again, I go back to Iran, that we had three prime ministers assassinated by Muslim fundamentalists, twice attempted the life of my husband by fundamentalists and communists, and also trying to kidnap me. And we were told that excesses were made, which is regrettable and not defendable. Then again, what I have to say is that after all these years, there had been a revolution, the Shah is dead, the monarchy is not there, there is the Islamic Republic. Those people who cared so much about human rights, about students in jail, about intellectuals in prison and torture, why do they remain silent today?
When people are in prison?
In Iran. Tortured, that the students tortured, intellectuals tortured, killed, assassinated, women stoned, flogged, fingers being cut, and so many thousands of people killed.
I want to ask you to remember that moment when you first left Tehran. Did you really think you were just going away for a couple of days? Because that's what it was billed as, a state a visit that you and the Shah were making.
It was said that we would leave just for rest for my husband. But although one keeps hope inside one's heart, but I really, frankly, seeing what has happened during the last months and all the hysteria and all the international situation, I didn't believe that it's possible to return.
Well, let me ask a more practical question. Did you pack for more than 2 days?
When I seen some important newspaper in America saying that the Shah left with 100 suitcases, first of all, there were not 100 suitcases. It was maybe 10 or 15, and most of them were clothes, unuseful, and one suitcase was full of gifts that we gave around in different countries we went, and one of them was full of books I took with me. Otherwise, even if there was in 15 suitcases with all the group which came out, there was nothing valuable in them.
Why did your husband leave?
Well, he had always said that I don't want to keep my throne by spreading the blood of my people. And he thought that by leaving, maybe it will quiet down the hysteria.
I'm afraid I have to ask you to begin to recount that period when you went to
Egypt, Morocco, Bahamas, Mexico, New York, Texas, Panama, Egypt. My husband was ill. We didn't know where we could go, even at midnight of the previous day. We were hearing what's happening in Iran, the killing and assassination of all those people who had worked for us. And also what was said in the news and written in the press. It was very difficult, but I had to survive for him, for my children, for my own dignity. A revolution had happened. It's understandable if it's humanly very hard. And then also when you are not in power anymore, so many people change. But at the same time, there are those people who remain friends, unknown people who write to you, who encourage you, which in those days gave me a lot of courage. And I always say that life is a struggle for all of us. You can lose your country, your power, your home, your whatever belonging, your dear ones. But you should not lose yourself in the struggle of life.
You talk to Iranians around the world, and you still talk to people in Iran.
Yes, and many young people. And I receive a lot of email from them, especially for those who have been born after the revolution or they were young when we left. They write to me their telephone numbers, and they want me to call them. It gives me a great satisfaction. Of course, I don't mention my name. Sometimes I write them a code name, or I just say I'm the one that you send an email to, or most of them immediately recognize me, and so I tell them, be careful, don't pronounce my name, and some of them, they say, we don't care. It's really very touching for me, and I feel for them, and what I can do from here by just giving them hope and courage that things are not going to stay like this.
Thank you, Empress.
Thank you very much. And if my compatriots hear me in the United States, I say hello to them, and since we are close to our New Year Nowruz, I wish them a very good Nowruz and really, hopefully, the beginning of a real spring.
The Empress Farah Pahlavi. She just published a memoir, An Enduring Love, My Life with the Shah. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.